all the atrocities committed against them, holding the inhabitants of the land responsible for whatever happens to them, regardless of whether they fought to defend their existence and liberate their territory, despairing the victims of colonialism by making them believe that the cost of any confrontation is greater than what they can endure, and that the only measure of victory or defeat is who suffers more. In other words, the significant sacrifices made in each battle are seen as a defeat and a testament to the inability to confront colonialism. Therefore, the best course of action is to submit and surrender. If you choose to stand up against it, the second rule applies. You are accountable for everything that happens to you. Even if you opt not to confront it, you, due to your so-called retrograde, barbaric, and savage nature, are responsible for everything that occurs when the colonizer decides to exterminate or expel you from your land. It's true that the 20th century witnessed a significant shift with the establishment of a system of international laws, including international humanitarian law, which criminalizes collective punishment and the excessive use of force. However, this legal framework has remained almost entirely in the hands of the white man, the collective West, and the global North. Regarding the peoples of the global South, our countries, Africa, Latin America, and Asia, they have continued to be subjected to the same barbaric and savage colonial and slavery policies that dehumanize the victims of colonialism and slavery, blaming them for all the crimes committed by the colonial machinery. In our countries and throughout all regions of the global South, the Requerimiento remained the guiding document. It marked a foundational moment in the history of colonial genocide, a brief and brazen text that opened the door to centuries of bloodshed against entire peoples under the banner of eliminating the savages or expanding civilization, and under the slogan, "You are the guilty ones." In 2023, 2024, and 2025, we observe the descendants of the colonizers stationed at the borders of the Gaza Strip, facing the Palestinian people, reciting the same text to them. In this episode, we will not delve into the foundational text of colonial brutality, but rather the colonial politics itself, which persists to this day and holds the victims accountable for everything the colonizers inflict upon them. We will also examine the criteria of cost, feasibility, the price of battles and wars, and their usefulness as measures of victory and defeat. In the 20th century, specifically between 1952 and 1960, the British Empire encountered an armed uprising in Kenya, referred to as the Mau Mau Uprising. This liberation movement aimed to reclaim the lands and rights of the Kikuyu tribes, which had been taken by British colonists. Britain responded to the uprising with excessive violence, many times greater than the actual threat, reminiscent of the tactics used today by the occupiers in Gaza. The British casualties during this 8-year war were limited to just a few dozen soldiers and 32 white settlers. In return, Britain launched a campaign of extermination that led to the deaths of at least 12,000 Kenyans, according to official figures. Some historians believe the actual number of victims exceeded 20,000. Additionally, 1,090 rebels were hanged. The colonial authorities did not stop there. They arrested over 150,000 people and confined them in mass detention camps. We're referring exclusively to civilians. In these camps, tens of thousands died from hunger, disease, and torture. Some studies estimate that the number of victims from death and torture reached 100,000 people. The British detention camps were not as we imagine. They included fenced villages with barbed wire designed to break the spirit through hunger and systematic humiliation. The villagers were stripped of their lands and confined in what were called new villages under strict surveillance and guarded by local militias loyal to the colonial regime. They were subjected to extreme living conditions marked by hunger and humiliation. Famine and disease claimed the lives of thousands of children. Of course, Great Britain did not acknowledge its responsibility in this humanitarian disaster and chose to blame the victims, When cases of child malnutrition spread in detention camps and relocated villages in 1954, a British politician accused families of deliberately allowing their children to die in order to gain international sympathy. When the crime reached a point where half of the children under 10 in some areas were dying from starvation and epidemics, a colonial official justified the deaths by claiming that the mothers were unaware of the value of proteins. At the height of the repression, which led to the deaths of tens of thousands of Kenyans, whether at the hands of the British Army, militias, or in detention camps, it is important to remember that this mass crime and genocide did not come at a high cost to Great Britain. In fact, during the 8 years of the uprising, only 32 white settlers were killed in Kenya. In such circumstances, the British colonial secretary, Alan Lennox Boyd, a minister in Churchill's government, whom official history regards as a hero, appeared before the British Parliament to defend the atrocities committed by his army. He claimed that the Mau Mau rebellion was not merely a disturbance of security, but rather a burst of primitive evil that necessitated exceptional measures. Who then is responsible for the crime? According to that logic, it's the very primitive evil itself, in other words, the victim. Perhaps the closest example linking British colonial mentality to current Israeli policy is found in the scorched earth strategy. When a white settler, a soldier, or even a pro-colonial official was killed in a specific area, the response was swift and brutal. Entire villages were attacked, people were executed in fields, huts were burned, and thousands of civilians were captured, all aimed at punishing the environment that sheltered the revolutionaries. Similarly, when British forces executed Mau Mau prisoners, they hung their bodies in villages to instill fear in the remaining insurgents and their supporting communities. We're not talking about events that happened centuries ago, but rather crimes committed between 1952 and 1960. This type of offense is what colonial powers refer to as the reimposition of deterrence equation. This equation dictates that the decision lies with the indigenous people. You are responsible for the consequences, and if you attempt to capture or kill a soldier, you will pay an unimaginable price. We will destroy your cities over your heads. The aim was to maximize the cost of resistance. The Mau Mau fighters were armed with rifles and rudimentary crossbows. How did Britain confront them? With planes, cannons, and the deployment of vastly superior forces, equipped with the most advanced weapons, equipment, and ammunition of the time. Colonization is not founded on the principle of an eye for an eye, but rather on the principle of many heads for one eye. The colonizer's aim is to create the notion that the blood of the colonizers holds value, while that of the indigenous people is expendable, able to be spilled in puddles as retaliation for a single injury among their ranks. This form of collective punishment and these equations aim to shift the focus of cost and effectiveness onto the victims. In other words, the goal is to cauterize the conscience by asserting that you are responsible for everything that happens to you, and therefore you will have no choice but to surrender. Every attempt to resist will come at a steep price for you, and that steep price will be interpreted as defeat. It is your responsibility to question whether what you are doing is effective or beneficial. You should also constantly ask yourself why we did this. In Palestine, this equation is as old as the occupying entity itself, but it took on its most horrific form after October 7, 2023. The statements from the Israeli officials about returning Gaza to the Stone Age are merely echoes of the words spoken by British generals in Kenya during the 1950s, when they threatened to revert tribes to their primitive state if they did not comply. Whether it was a Kenyan village in the 50s or a camp in Gaza in 2025, the core remains the same, an attempt to force victims into believing they are guilty. Once they are convinced of this, the easiest option becomes surrender. On May 8, 1945, as the world celebrated the defeat of Nazi Germany and the conclusion of World War II, the French colonial administration committed one of its most horrific massacres in Algeria. Thousands of Algerians took to the streets in various cities to celebrate the end of the conflict and peacefully demand freedom, following France's unfulfilled promises of reform. France had occupied Algeria for 113 years. The French colonial forces responded by opening fire on the demonstrators in the city of Sétif. In the aftermath of this event, riots broke out, during which some Algerian revolutionaries killed nearly 100 European settlers. The French retaliation was brutal and devastating, a comprehensive military campaign of repression that lasted for weeks, during which France used all modern military resources against a defenseless population. The leaders of the French occupation launched a large-scale offensive against towns and rural areas. This operation effectively amounted to a scorched earth policy. Dozens of villages were completely destroyed, collective punishments and indiscriminate reprisals were implemented, and massive aerial bombings dropped hundreds of tons of explosives on entire towns. Additionally, naval bombardments from warships along the coast, summary executions on the battlefield, and even the use of rudimentary gas chambers to suffocate hundreds of Algerians at once were carried out. The outcome was horrifying from every perspective. In contrast to the 102 colonists killed, and no more than 102, French forces killed approximately 45,000 Algerians in just a few weeks, according to official figures from the Algerian government. The majority of the victims were unarmed civilians, including a significant number of children and infants who perished alongside their mothers under the bombs and bullets of the French army. It's important to remember that these brutal massacres occurred at a time when power in France was held by General Charles de Gaulle, who, like Churchill, is regarded by official historiography as a great hero and one of the architects of humanity's salvation from Nazism. The French occupying authorities believed that their extermination campaign had ensured security for a decade. While this claim is morally unacceptable, from a different perspective, these massacres were one of the factors that paved the way for the outbreak of the Algerian War of Liberation 9 years later, in 1954. The French colonial narrative in Algeria in 1945 bears a disturbing resemblance to the current Zionist colonial discourse. French propaganda depicted the massacres of May 1945 as a legitimate response to an alleged bloody rebellion by the Algerians. Colonial authorities spoke of protecting innocent civilians, of course, referring to European settlers, and restoring order, which was supposedly disrupted by savage bands. To justify the genocide, the French labeled the villages as hotbeds of criminals that needed to be raided and viewed most Algerians as either fighters or accomplices. Once again, the colonial rhetoric was based on the same principles we mentioned at the beginning of this episode: dehumanizing the victims, blaming them for the crimes committed by colonial forces, and regarding the high human cost borne by colonized peoples as evidence of their defeat. What we discussed regarding the crimes committed by France in Algeria in 1945 was repeated with even greater brutality following the outbreak of the Algerian War of Independence 9 years later. It follows the same pattern that Britain adhered to in Kenya, India, and in other colonies, the same approach that Germany applied in Namibia in the early 20th century, the same actions that the United States executed in the Philippines, the same methods that the Netherlands imposed in Aceh, Indonesia, the same practices that Belgium carried out in the Congo, the same tactics that Italy employed in Libya, and the same strategies that settlers implemented in Australia. We could continue listing colonial experiences, and it would take us hundreds of hours to analyze their details without ever reaching a conclusion. In summary, all the colonial experiences around the world can be read in a single book. We might consider that book titled Requerimiento, the Spanish papal text on colonization and slavery that we examined in the first episode. All colonial experiences essentially represent a singular experience that recur repeatedly, even in terms of language and expressions. The white colonial leader in the United States, John Chivington, during his extermination campaigns against the indigenous population in 1864, commanded his soldiers to eliminate them all without exception, famously stating, Kill the Indians, young and old, because the young, when they grow up, will become lice. This phrase was echoed almost verbatim in the Israeli context when Ayelet Shaked, who later became Israel's Minister of Justice, explicitly called for the murder of Palestinian mothers, saying, "They must go with their children because they gave birth to little snakes." This discursive parallelism is not merely propaganda or a simple justification for genocide. There is an additional yet crucial objective to influence the consciousness of the victims of colonialism, as we mentioned earlier, to persuade them that they must change if they wish to deserve life. But it's more likely that they deserve this life outside their homeland, because this land, according to colonial logic, no longer belongs to them, it has become ours. خارج أرضكم لأن هالأرض صارت ملكنا. The aim of today's episode is not to list colonial experiences, nor to claim that they all stem from the same pattern, with the only difference being the methods of killing, which are influenced by technological advancements. Instead of using knives, swords, or rifles, we have transitioned to killing with aerial bombs, chemical weapons, and even through artificial intelligence systems. One of the main purposes of this episode is to highlight that in all wars for the liberation from colonial slavery, the human cost has always been significantly higher for the indigenous population. There is always a vast disparity between the advanced military capabilities of the colonizers and the modest resources of the subjugated peoples. The cost is always comparable to what we have seen in Gaza, Algeria, and Kenya. In all colonial experiences, especially those of a settlement type, for every person lost by the invaders, they exterminate at least 100 natives. The intent of genocide is always present, and the colonizer consistently shifts the issue of cost and benefit onto the colonized peoples. Instead of holding the colonizer and their agents accountable for what has happened, the victim is encouraged to question whether their actions were justified or if they were the cause of the anger and crimes committed by the colonizers against them, their families, and their country. The benefit of confrontation is also questioned. Was all this cost worth it, or was it in vain? In most colonial experiences, the high price paid by indigenous peoples did not signify defeat, even though it may have seemed that way in every battle fought. In fact, in many instances, the moments where colonial powers believed they had defeated indigenous peoples were, in reality, the very moments that marked the beginning of the end of colonialism. The same was true in Vietnam, in Algeria in 1959, and in all the countries that managed to free themselves from colonial oppression, despite the immense sacrifices that on the surface seemed to represent defeats in most confrontations. However, does this mean that the high costs and significant sacrifices are enough on their own to overthrow colonialism? No, not at all. Unlike the liberation victories achieved by indigenous peoples in various colonial experiences, from Algeria to Latin America, Africa, and Asia, the world has also witnessed instances of mass genocide where settler colonialism triumphed and seized lands, as seen in North America and Australia, for example. In addition to a strong willingness to sacrifice, the victory of indigenous peoples requires certain objective conditions. The first of these is an unbreakable will and a commitment to justice, as a weak will is the key to the defeat that colonizers aim to impose upon us. Conversely, a steadfast will and dedication to justice shift the question of cost and feasibility back to the colonizer's side. In other words, colonizers start to wonder whether their actions will yield results and if the colonial project justifies the price they're paying. This is what happened in Algeria, Vietnam, Namibia, and Libya, as well as in most of the colonies that managed to gain their freedom. In addition to a commitment to justice and an unwavering will, it's essential to achieve material conditions that will allow the struggle against colonialism to continue. The most crucial of these conditions is the presence of forces that support the oppressed peoples and a clear understanding of the agents and allies of the colonizer. Another important material condition is the geographical reality, which helps to avoid siege. In wars against colonizers, the empire can never be destroyed. Our limit is to inflict suffering upon it. Our greatest achievement is, at best, to render the tips of their weapons ineffective. However, in any case, the refusal to surrender and the unwillingness to associate defeat and victory with cost are the fundamental keys to achieving victory.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to you all. Greetings from Tehran, Iran. You are listening to Iran Radio. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with Let's Recite the Holy Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Holy Quran at level 2. That will be followed by our varied radio productions feature. Then it's time for our final program, this hour, Viewpoints. The program presents an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of the Islamic world today. Stay with us for the next hour.
Let's recite the Quran.
وَإِذَا قَرَأْتَ الْقُرْآنَ جَعَلْنَا بَيْنَكَ وَبَيْنَ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْآخِرَةِ حِجَابًا مَسْتُورًا
القرآن نور وبيان القرآن هدي الإيمان القرآن مسك الختام القرآن عليك سلام
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Welcome to this episode of Let's Recite the Quran. My name is Brother Muhammad, and with me in the studio we have Brother Masoom, Brother Hassan and Hussein, and we're missing Ali. Wherever you are, Brother Ali, we miss you a lot in the studio, in this episode at least. Inshallah, we will be continuing the recitation of Surah Al-Ma'arij, chapter number 70 of the Noble Quran, from verse number 35, inshallah. Brother Masoom, I kindly ask you to please recite verses number 35, 36, and 37. They're quite short verses, and they do not have much of complications in them. Bismillah, Brother Masoom.
Yes. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أولئك في جنات مكرمون فما للذين كفروا قبلك مهطعين عن اليمين وعن الشمال عزين
أحسنتم. Very beautiful recitation. أولئك في جنات. Again, why do we do a ghunna or a stretch in جنة?
Because it's نون مشدد.
نون مشدد. نون مشدد, whenever we have a تشديد نون, right? We give it a sound of ghunna, correct? A small stretch and a nasal sound, correct? And then جنات مكرمون. Originally it was جنات مكرمون.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we convert it into جنات مكرمون?
Because of ruling Idgham.
Idgham. Idgham of what and what?
Noon Sakin would mean.
Exactly. So Jannatin has a Tanween at the end. And Tanween in reality is actually a Noon Sakin. at the end, correct? So with that nun sakin, we have a mim that follows it. We do idgham. Idgham means merging of two letters. Nun, in this case, with mim. Now, what letters do we apply idgham for?
Yarmalun letters.
Yarmalun. Ya, ra, mim, lam, waw, and nun. Any of these letters, when they're followed by, when they come after a nun sakin or a tanween, we do idgham. Merge that letter with the nun sakin and tanween or tanween before that. And we also give it a ghunna if it is not lam and ra. Of the yarmalun letters, only for yamun letters, ya, mim, waw, and nun, we give it a ghunna. Ghunna means a short nasal sound and a small stretch, right?
Sure.
Jannatin mukramun was the original before the application of idgham and ghunna. After the application of idgham and ghunna, it would become jannatin mukramun. Keep in mind, mukramun, mukramun, it's a tafkhim letter in this case, right? It's a heavy recitation. Ra is with a heavy recitation in this case. Again, we have a few tafkhim letters in the verse after that as well. Verse number 36. Kafaru. Kafaru. Qibala. Qibalaka. Qibalaka. Right? Muhti'in. Muhti'in. Ta, qaf, and ra. All of these three letters in the recitation, they are the letters of tafkhim. Ahsantum, a very beautiful recitation.
Ulaika fi jannatin mukramun.
They will be in gardens, honored.
Fama lilladhina kafaru qibalaka muhti'in.
So what is the matter with those who disbelieve, hastening from before you, O Muhammad?
عن اليمين وعن الشمال عزين.
To sit on your right and your left in separate groups.
Verses number 38 and 39, I'll ask Brother Hassan to please take the honors of reciting these two verses for us. Let me help you out with the recitation.
أَيَطْمَعُ كُلُّ امْرِئٍ مِّنْهُمْ أَن يُدْخَلَ جَنَّةَ نَعِيمٍ كَلَّا إِنَّا خَلَقْنَاهُمْ مِمَّا يَعْلَمُونَ كُلُّ امْرِئٍ مِّنْهُمْ أَن يُدْخَلَ جَنَّةَ نَعِيمٍ
أَيَطْمَعُ كُلُّ امْرِئٍ مِّنْهُمْ أَن يُدْخَلَ جَنَّةَ نَعِيمٍ كلا إن خلقناهم مما يعلمون.
I think you know the correct recitation, Brother Hassan, but I think the confidence is a bit lacking in you. Try to be very confident in your recitation. Kullumri'im. Originally it was kullumri'in with a noon at the end because of tanween, but because of idgham after that tanween, remember, nun sakin followed by a mim. Mim is one of the yarmanun letters. It becomes idgham, and it is with ghunna because it is one of the yamun letters, correct?
Ayatma'u kullu mri'in minhum.
Right? And keep in mind that at the beginning we have qalqala. Ayatma'u. Not ayatma'u. Right? Ayatma'u. Ayatma'u. There is an echoing sound. Why do we do and where do we do qalqala? Qalqala basically means whenever we have qutub jad letters, qaf, ta, ba, jim, and dal. Any of these letters, when they are sakin, we give it an echoing sound. And the reason we do this is because these letters are very similar when they are pronounced with sakin. To distinguish these letters from the other, we give them an echoing sound without any haraka, without any vowel. There is no fatha, kasra, dhamma that we give it to these letters.
Ayatma'u,
right?
Kullu mri'in minhum.
This ghunna on the mim, the minhum, the beginning mim, we give it a ghunna because of idgham of this tanween before that. Imri'in minhum. It was this originally, correct? But we do idgham.
Kullu mri'in minhum.
And there is no ghunna at the end of minhum.
because we have ayyudkhala. Ayyudkhala, the alif or the hamza at the beginning of ayyudkhala is one of the non-mouth letters. So there is no ikhfa or any other ruling that implies that we do a ghunna here. Right? So it's normal idhar. أَيَطَمَعُ كُلُّ امْرِئٍ مِّنْهُمْ أَن يُدْخَلَ جَنَّةَ نَعِيمٍ. Again, قَلْقَلَ. أَن يُدْخَلَ. يُدْخَلَ. Keep in mind, خَا is a تَفْخِيم letter. Right? تَفْخِيم means a rounded mouth and a heavy voice. It's not أَن يُدْخَلَ. يُدْخَلَ. No. يُدْخَلَ. This is the correct one. يُدْخَلَ. Correct? Again, because of Nun Mushaddad, Nun Shadda, Jannata Na'im. There is a small ghunna involved. Jannata Na'im. Kalla inna. Not inna khalaqnahum. Inna. There is a stretch. There is a mad, but it's a very small mad. Just two counts, okay? Inna khalaqnahum. Again, qalqala. Khalaqnahum. Not khalaqnahum. Khalaqnahum. Right? And the kha again is a letter of tafkhim. Kha, round and heavy voice. Mimma ya'lamun. Because of the interest of time, I'm not going to open up all of these rulings again, because we have mimma again, there is an idgham involved with ghunna and so on. I will just leave it to that, and I will advise Brother Hassan to practice the stretches, the makharij, and be confident. And for all the listeners, if you find that it's difficult to go with the tajweed, there is not a single tiny needle bit of a problem when you go very slow when you're in the learning phase. Take your time. The time is all that you've got. أَيَطَمَعُ كُلُّ امْرِئٍ مِّنْ. Take your time, it's fine. Do it in a very counting voice, in a very counting manner. There is no problem in that. This, slowly you increase your pace, you'll get the hang of it, inshallah.
أَيَطَمَعُ كُلُّ امْرِئٍ مِّنْهُمْ أَن يُدْخَلَ جَنَّةَ نَعِيمٍ.
Does every person among them aspire to enter a garden of pleasure? No, indeed, we have created them from that which they know.
Finally, we'll come to Brother Hussein. Please recite for us verses number... I think we'll go for verse number 40, just one verse, and we'll be finished. We'll be finished for this episode.
فَلَا أُقْسِمُ بِرَبِّ الْمَشَارِقِ وَالْمَغَارِبِ إِنَّا لَقَادِرُونَ.
أحسنتم. I think this is one of the very beautiful verses to use for the practice of تفخيم. Take a look at it. فَلَا, again, first of all, there is a med. فَلَا, what kind of a med is it, Brother Hussein?
It's جَائِز مُنْفَصِل.
جَائِز, what is it?
مُنْفَصِل.
مُنْفَصِل, جَائِز مُنْفَصِل, meaning that you can go up to 5 or 6 beats or keep it up to 4 beats. It's up to you. And then we have قَلْقَلَ أُقْسِمُ, echoing sound for the قَاف, because it's قَاف with a sukoon, right? فَلَا أُقْسِمُ, right? That's that. Now, from this point onwards, there are many tafkhim. Almost every word has tafkhim, and we should focus on that. Birabbil, birabbil, rounded, heavy, ra. Not birabbil, birabbil. Look at the difference. With tarqiq, it will be birabbil. With tafkhim, birabbil. Right?
Yes.
Rounded and a heavy sound. Al-mashariqi, qaf, tafkhim. Not al-mashariqi. Mashariqi, right? Wal magharibi, not magharibi. Magha, rounded voice, rounded mouth with a heavy voice. Wal magharibi, inna laqadirun, not laqadirun, laqadirun. Now, if you practice these two different recitations with tafkhim and tarqiq, you will know the difference between the two. It is very distinguishable in this case. فلا أقسم برب المشارق والمغارب إنا لقادرون.
فلا أقسم برب المشارق والمغارب إنا لقادرون.
So I swear by the Lord of all risings and settings that indeed we are able.
Let's recite these verses together. We started from verse number 35, right?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أولئك في جنات مكرمون.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أولئك في جنات مكرمون.
فما للذين كفروا قبلك مهطعين
فما للذين كفروا قبلك مهطعين
عن اليمين وعن الشمال عزين
عن اليمين وعن الشمال عزين
أيطمع كل امرئ منهم أن يدخل جنة نعيم
أيطمع كل امرئ منهم أن يدخل جنة نعيم
كلا إنا خلقناهم مما يعلمون
كلا إنا خلقناهم مما يعلمون.
You want to recite it once again in a synchronous voice?
كلا إنا خلقناهم مما يعلمون
كلا إنا خلقناهم مما يعلمون
فلا أقسم برب المشارق والمغارب إنا لقادرون
فلا أقسم برب المشارق والمغارب إنا لقادرون
صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
And that was a beautiful recitation of Surah Al-Ma'arij from verse number 35 straight down to verse number 40. And inshallah, in the next episode, we have the last few verses of Surah Al-Ma'arij from verse number 41 to 44. And don't go away, join us in the next episode as well as we conclude the Surah Al-Ma'arij. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
5 a.m. waking up for Fajr. Gotta make wudu, gotta pray my sunnah. Got me ghuskal, clip my nails. Looking outside, the sun is rising. Up in the sky, everybody's rushing. Gotta get down to the masjid. Gotta say salam to the imam. Sitting in the first saf, chilling in the back saf. Gotta make my mind up, do what the Prophet did. It's Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to the Ajr. Miss Wakim, Miss Wakim.
Yeah!
Miss Wakim, Miss Wakim.
Whoa!
Pray, 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 pray. Gotta read Surah the Kahf. 12:45, the imam's on the minbar, talking about something like fiqh as a cat. They're whispering, chatting from the crowd. Don't they know that it's a haram? I stand up, you stand up. Prayer's about to start by the qamat yusala. Foot to foot, shoulder to shoulder. Just don't step on me. Sitting in the first saf, chilling in the back saf. Gotta make my mind up, do what the Prophet did. It's Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to the Ajr. Miss Wakim, Miss Wakim.
Yeah!
Miss Wakim, Miss Wakim.
Whoa!
Pray, 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 pray. Gotta read Surah the Kahf. It's Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy.
It's a twisted teardrop, a leaf, a head-bent paisley that is rooted in Iran's ancient history and civilization, a reoccurring motif that symbolizes life and eternity. It's a pattern with a long-lasting past, one that reflects the Persian culture and its traditions. The paisley, known as botejeqe in Iran, is a design that appears on most of the country's handicrafts. Due to its visual potentials and variations, the botejeqe design has been used on a variety of handmade products during the course of the years.
Pate is a traditional form of needlework mostly produced in Iran's Kerman province. This beautiful handicraft is usually adorned with the botejeqe design and is seen on the everyday objects that people use.
A typical pate design is made up of a paisley in each corner, a toranj or flower motif in the center, and an arch or mihrab on each side. This time-consuming and fiber-rich embellishment is what gives the pate its value and desirability. The paisley is also a reoccurring pattern in one of Iran's ancient handicrafts known as pottery. Designing earthenware in Iran started about 4000 BC, and since then, the paisley has been repeatedly used on clay objects in different forms and patterns. Another popular artwork that abundantly makes use of the paisley is reverse glass painting. This art flourished about 600 years ago in Iran and is still one of the best mediums for expressing Iran's ancient signs and motifs. But where does the word bote actually come from, and what's the story behind this symbol? Well, bote is a Persian word meaning bush or a shrub. Some would even take it to mean a palm leaf, cluster of leaves, or a flower bud. The term jeqe refers to the leaves that adorn the crown of a king and symbolize humbleness and modesty. The Botejeqe design, which is a sign of strength and resistance, originated from the cypress tree, a Zoroastrian symbol of life and eternity. This design was first seen as an ancient motif in the artworks of the Achaemenid era. During the Sasanid dynasty, the Botejeqe design flourished in different forms and shapes, and in the Safavid era, some 500 years ago, this motif reached new heights. Persian rug designs include a remarkably varied range of patterns and tastes, depending on the nature and the conditions of its production. The Persian rug has always been a great canvas for displaying the paisley in its different forms and variations. Iranian weavers have used this pattern to express notions like life, birth, and eternity in their rugs. Zaribafi is one of Iran's most beautiful and delicate handicrafts, which basically means weaving a silk fabric. Now, elegant handicraft has its roots in history, which means it belongs to more than 2,000 years ago. Although through the years it's gone through various transformations, the Botejeqe design has always been an integral part of its pattern. Zaribafi was welcomed into the age of the Safavid dynasty back in the late 15th century. Provinces such as Kashan, Yazd, and Isfahan became major centers for the creation of this art. The head-bent paisley is seen on most of Iran's handicrafts because of its unique features, its beauty, and visual potentials. But you see, this ancient symbol doesn't just charm us on various handmade products. It's also part of various other artistic creations. Today we're going to meet an artist whose new outlook on this symbol has led to various remarkable creations. Ali Sa'i is an artist who has dedicated 15 years of his life creating works with the techniques of miniature and illumination. The paisley is one of those symbols that is repeatedly used in illumination, but Ali Sa'i has taken this art to the next level. Illumination is basically an art form that is centered on certain rules and artistic regulations. The colors usually have a neutral tone, and everything is drawn in small scale. Ali Sa'i's works, however, use bright, vivid colors and are displayed in big sizes. Tahira Atrvash is a graphic artist and a researcher who has spent a year researching about the paisley and its origins. With not many sources at hand, she has managed to delve into the history of this ancient design. Today, the paisley is part of our daily life. It's become a significant design that is used on functional objects like bags, purses, shoes, and even tablecloths. The story behind it, however, still remains unknown for many of us. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting it. And my guest speakers, Syed Abdullah and Brother Yasser, helping me criticize movies with religious and spiritual themes. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Yasser, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Always a pleasure being with you, Brother Muhammad Jawad.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. And the pleasure is all mine. Sayyid Abdullah, how are you? Assalamu alaikum. Greetings to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. One of the movies that we decided actually to start criticizing is, a fairly old one. What Dreams May Come, produced in 1998, directed by Vincent Ward, featuring actors and actresses such as Robin Williams, Cuba Gooding Jr., and Jessica Brooks Grant, to just name a few. IMDb gave this movie 7 points out of 10, while Rotten Tomatoes gave this movie 52%, and Prime Video 7 out of 10. The film tells the story of Chris Nielsen, a man who dies in a car accident and enters a vibrant afterlife, only to discover his wife, Annie, has committed suicide out of grief. He embarks on a quest to find and reunite with her in the afterlife. That's about the plot of this movie. And before we get on with our program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, we'd like to have a little break by listening to a short part of this movie or trailer of the movie What Dreams May Come, produced in 1998, directed by Vincent Ward. Stay with us.
The moment that comes for everyone. Has come for Chris Nielsen.
You've died, Chris.
If heaven were a place of beauty...
Oh!
Boy, I screwed up. I'm in dog heaven.
...and wonder...
Nice place you got here.
No.
Nice place you got here.
We all paint our own surroundings. You're the first guy I know to use real paint.
...where you felt no fear.
I'm gonna drown.
Can't. You're already dead.
Oh.
...and knew only joy.
I can fly.
Yeah! It's your world!
Could you forget the past?
Welcome back to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Syed Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie What Dreams May Come, produced in 1998, directed by Vincent Ward. Of course, we haven't finished the criticism of this movie in the last two episodes we had together, and I invited Brother Yasser and Syed Abdullah again to the studio to help me criticize the movie What Dreams May Come. Well, Brother Yasser, let me start with you. What moral and philosophical questions does this movie raise about afterlife? I'm talking about what dreams may come.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think one of the philosophical and main philosophical questions that is shown in this movie is that is there a particular ability for somebody in the afterlife to change their status, to change their state, rather. That's
yes.
That's the thing. There doesn't, you know, critique or show that there isn't an afterlife. No, it shows that after death there is something, and it shows that you can meet certain people and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But is it possible that in that particular position that a person is in, is it possible to change the state? I.e., for example, the wife was in hell. Now, is it possible in that particular state by means of the love that the husband had, again, the concept of love and the ability and the changing nature of love,
mm-hmm.
to bring her, because of that love, from the depths of hell,
yes.
to heaven, and to create that family structure again?
You're referring actually to the idea of intercession.
Well, intercession in this type of
sense.
I
might ask you actually this, maybe in one of the other episodes. That, you know, takes a huge... Actually, another session, I think.
Yeah.
But
we mean by intercession and so on and so, but this is what this is depicting. It's not intercession per se, but because a person obviously, by their own hands, has done something that they are deserving to being punished. Now, is it that somebody else who has a particular state in heaven or in the afterlife is the ability to do that before that particular judgment is given?
Yes.
And that's one of a very interesting question. Obviously, according to the Islamic beliefs, we believe, and it is such that once a person passes over or dies in this particular world,
yes.
they will only go with what they have taken with them.
Yes. In this movie, it is portrayed that love persists after death.
Yeah.
Is that true? According to Said Abdullah, love doesn't exist in the afterlife.
So I wanted to answer this some other place as well.
Yes.
What he means by love, we may have to change the meaning. What we mean by love or infatuation. I mean, he mentioned in the one of the lust, for example.
Yeah.
What we mean by true love? True love is what? True love is that you just want closeness to somebody. That true love only exists between God and his creation.
Mm.
And then obviously between the awliya and so on and so forth. So that particular love that exists is love towards goodness, love towards truth. Not to a particular person, not love in terms of that type of infatuation or to the thing of a particular person. And that love is culminated not physically, but a bond that is created between you and a particular object of love. For example.
Like platonic love, you mean?
No, even higher than that. Uh-huh. Platonic love is different. This is even higher than that love. Why? Because, for example, again, in the physical world,
yes.
as a person, you know, when it comes to the month of Muharram, for example, a person
right.
goes to the majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam,
mm-hmm.
you know, for mourning, but also there's a love and a bond that is culminated between that person in the majlis and Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes.
Sometimes that love cannot be shown here in the physical world. So it is possible and it's very likely that if that love is true and truly culminated, that love will be seen in the hereafter. But it's not a physical love. It is something far beyond that.
Mm.
So the meaning of love needs to change. That love, you know, as Sayyid himself mentioned, emotions are intensified.
Yes.
That love is intensified. But
yes.
it's not a love that is a physical love, or love that is a worldly love. No, it's love based on certain principles and ideals.
Yes.
That Imam Hussein alayhi salam or whoever else is a representative of God. God loves him. Therefore, I love him because God loves him.
I see. Thank you very much. That's a very nice, interesting point. Sayyid Abdullah, what is the significance of travels between different realms according to the movies? We see that, right?
Yeah, they do travel between realms, universes themselves, right? So if you're in heaven, there are different universes and you can go to each other, see each other in their own universe. And then you have that transit from heaven to hell itself. Going deep, so depends. Like for because the lady herself committed suicide, she was in a state of grief. Now, in order for her to elevate herself and go up, she needs to change her mindset, and she needs to believe in things in order for her to go up. So obviously the concept of the soul evolving, the soul being educated, the soul becoming or growing and getting over things, that will allow you to travel from one place to another. So even him, when he was down, he felt cold and he fell asleep. Then she woke him up and they found himself in heaven. So that growth of the soul maybe is one of the things that allows you to move from one place to another, from one realm to another.
Right.
But that's just science fiction, though.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Viewpoints, the movie.